It's one of the first questions anyone asks about you before you're even born. Boy or girl? Parents have long looked to genitalia for a definitive answer. Right off the bat, for many of us, a penis means it's time to bust out the blue paint and toy trucks. A vagina calls for dollies and Barbies and pink frilly stuff. These so-called norms are changing, but not without some death throes. As a society, our understanding of gender is slowly and often painfully becoming a bit more nuanced. A workshop happening at Southern Oregon University today nudges this dialogue along, offering expertise on how to best support young people who are transgender, gender nonconforming, or questioning their gender identity. The event is being led by two longtime advocates who we welcome to the studio today. They've both spent decades working with young people who don't fit in a box and often suffer trauma because of that. One is a registered associate clinical social worker at the Los Angeles Gender Center, where he provides clinical care and therapy for trans youth, adults, and their families. He's been a voice for the queer and trans community for 20 years. Over the last 10 of them, he's led many trainings, both in the U.S. and internationally, on privilege, heteronormativity, heterosexism, and what these things mean for gender and sexual minorities. Aiden Olson Kennedy, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure to have you here. We also are joined by the medical director of the Center for Trans Youth and Health Development at the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. She's an adolescent medicine physician specializing in the care of youth with gender identity disorder, HIV, and chronic pain. She's board certified in pediatrics and adolescent medicine. We would like to welcome Johanna Olson Kennedy to the show. Welcome, Johanna.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you guys are, right after this interview, you're dashing off to a workshop at SOU, and we'll give more details about that later. Joe, could we start with the basics here and define transgendered?
Absolutely. So transgender is a word that's used to define somebody who has an experience of gender that's different than their assigned sex at birth.
And is that different from gender nonconforming?
I think gender nonconforming usually refers to folks who have gender expression and behaviors that are not necessarily what might be expected from their assigned sex at birth, and is in some ways a broader category, but not necessarily. I think about when we use this way to describe that people are, it's people don't generally embrace an identity of being gender nonconforming. I think it's a way to sort of describe somebody and what they're doing with their gender expression and gender performance versus transgender, which may be an identity for somebody and may not, but it's a way for us to encapsulate a lot of different things happening for folks.
I think it's an interesting point that some of these words, we're defining people by what they are not rather than who they are. Aiden, can you give us a definition of cisgendered?
Sure. I think that it's important to note sort of off the bat that transgender and cisgender both are words that typically don't end in ED. And so sort of thinking about how we're describing and talking about identities for folks. So cisgender really is quite simple. It's your gender identity is aligned with your sex that's assigned at birth. It's a movement away from things such as real man or real woman, which is obviously problematic. And then we move to, you know, biological male, biological female. And so there's been an evolution of language to really address the inequity in the sense that what was considered the norm that everyone was being compared to were people who weren't trans. And so that always put trans people at the disadvantage. And so there is an attempt to equalize the language by saying transgender is your gender that is different than your assigned sex, and equally cisgender is that your gender identity happens to be the same as it is assigned. And it comes from chemistry, sort of CIS means same, matching.
And where is this effort to equalize language? I know I actually had some reservations preparing for this interview because the words that I grew up with are not acceptable anymore, and I'm happy for that. But mm-hmm. But where do you see these changes taking place, and how do you take part in changing?
I think it comes from two different places. I mean, certainly there's movement and evolving from the community themselves, and really saying, like, I think finding empowerment as a trans member of the community and saying, like, these words don't fit anymore, and so we're going to come up with our own language. And then I think that it comes from the other end, and in the sense of, like, scholarly or academic. And then those two places coming together in the negotiation of that. And sometimes that negotiation is heated and fiery, and there can be – and medical world, for sure – And so these different domains who are talking about gender and gender identity, most often and historically, those academically and in the medical field weren't trans people. And so they were talking about experiences and identities that they weren't living on a day-to-day basis. And then the trans community is saying those words, they don't fit how I feel. They don't fit my life. And so I think that Joe and I, we work really well in the sense that Joe being a cisgender medical provider and researcher and myself being a trans person who is a mental health provider, we're able to come together and have these information from a variety of places and then able to sort of bring that to the community. And there's places where Joe and I sort of, we don't always meet, but having those dialogues is really something that is a rare occurrence. And so we're able to bring that to audiences, which is really nice.
And Joe, in your work as a medical provider, do you use the diagnosis gender identity disorder? Can you tell us what that is, and is it a medical or a mental diagnosis?
So gender identity disorder actually doesn't exist anymore. It used to be in the DSM, or the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness, and in 2014, it got taken out when the DSM got revised to the version 5. And so it got replaced with an entity called gender dysphoria, which was a really important move because it took, again, it took the psychopathology out of the identity. And I think that was a really important move, and try to describe the distress that arises for some folks of trans experience instead of saying transgender itself is a mental illness, which was really a mistaken way to think about it, and put in the distress or the sort of things that were happening for people around their gender being different from their assigned sex at birth, and characterize that more fully. And I have gone through, when that change happened, I used to never use the code gender identity disorder. I didn't agree with it from a perspective of it really didn't characterize what young people were experiencing, but it also pathologized their identity. And so I did not use that diagnostic coding at all.
We're talking today with Joe Olson Kennedy. She's a doctor, the medical director of the Center for Trans Youth and Health Development at the Children's Hospital in LA. We also have Aiden Olson Kennedy, an associate clinical social worker at the Los Angeles Gender Center, talking with us about supporting transgendered youth. You are welcome to join this conversation. The phone number is 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Joe, you were just talking about this this gender identity disorder as a diagnosis coming out of the playbook, the handbook for doctors, in 2014. And now you use the words gender dysphoria. The second part of my question there was, in what ways is this a medical issue? And then where does the mental side come in? I think we could probably talk for the whole half hour about how the treatment of transgender people has changed over the last 50 years. But what's going on now, and what do you see as the line between what your responsibilities for medical care are versus where it's the mental side of things coming in?
Yeah, I do think it's really important for listeners to understand that there are folks who are of transgender experience that don't experience gender dysphoria. So I think when we think about what we're aiming for in our world of medical care, we're aiming to alleviate or help the symptoms of gender dysphoria, which can be in many, many cases assuaged or alleviated by medical interventions, which makes it this particular diagnosis unusual, because you have a diagnosis that's listed in the handbook of mental illness, and yet we have a medical interventions, including hormones and puberty blockers and surgical interventions, that help to alleviate dysphoria and this distress that arises for some people. So it really is an interesting, and what makes this diagnosis of gender dysphoria unique is that it really has a foot in both worlds currently. And there are advocates that say this shouldn't live in the world of mental health at all, but I do think it's important to understand that anxiety and depression and some other things that happen for people actually are what we would categorize as mental health challenges for people. So it's difficult, because you don't want to pathologize somebody's identity or experience around their gender, but at the same time, you want to be able to have a way to talk about this when people are first entering into care and they are experiencing a lot of gender dysphoria. there needs to be a way to sort of talk about that in the world of medical coding. It's also interesting, though, that once people start hormones or they have surgery, they still need to access care around those particular medical interventions, but they may or may not have gender dysphoria. So now you're left as a provider without any appropriate coding for that individual. There really needs to be code that says this is a person who needs ongoing care for hormone administration, which does not live at all in the world of mental health.
It certainly doesn't. I think we hear a lot about that, especially in regard to people where their gender is defining to their I'm thinking of people who are sentenced to prison. I've seen a lot of headlines about that, and that's a very much like you're in a box of either you're going to the male prison or you're going to the female prison, and then access to healthcare is not well reputed in that situation. When you talk about the mental side of it, it sounds like it's largely coming from trauma, from the outside, rather than a mental illness that maybe would be genetic or actually a mental illness. Aiden, can you talk about your experience as a counselor? Do you think trauma is inevitable for people with nonconforming gender identities in America?
I do. I think that there's a lot of microaggressions that happen on a day-to-day basis when your gender identity does not match your assigned sex at birth. And that starts very, very young in the sense that as you come to understand that your gender is different than your assigned sex, there are a lot of overt and covert messaging that happens around you're wrong, that's not right, or you get shamed in the sense of, particularly if you're a assigned boy and you're a young child and you're exploring female identity or femininity, whether you label it as such or you're just doing what feels natural. We have very clear messaging in our society about how not okay that is. And those are microaggressions and those are psychic traumas. They get internalized. And then, you know, as you get a little bit older, teenager, we start using really horrific language. And we usually use sexuality or femininity to push boys back into masculinity, because the worst possible thing is to be gay or to be girly as a man or a boy. And then there's the real world in the sense that, you know, when we look at crime statistics that are perpetrated against trans community, it's trans women of color, right? And so thinking about the internal experience of trauma, the external experiences of trauma around being gender nonconforming or being transgender is really, really profound. But I do think it's worth saying that as a trans person, and I've had a lot of conversations with clients and sort of anecdotally with my community, that and my own experiences when I was in therapy is that, you know, there's difficulty walking in the world around you when your gender presentation is not congruent with your identity and you're constantly being pronounced or use a birth name that just does not feel right for you, or people are sort of making a relationship with your physical body with your gender. But the other thing is that I think we don't always think about is the difficulty and the angst and the distress that trans and gender nonconforming people can have in a room completely by themselves. Because as you know, I talk about it as a mental health provider, what we know is that you can actually never get away from you. You are everywhere you go. And so, you know, sitting in a room by yourself or going to the bathroom or taking a shower, these things that we all have to do on a day-to-day basis are really, they cause a lot of distress and anxiety for trans people. Because even, you know, you're in the world and you're walking around and maybe people are reading your gender in a congruent way, there's still trauma on a daily basis of having a chest that is feminine in appearance that doesn't match for your identity and so forth. And so gender dysphoria certainly can be and is about genitals, but gender dysphoria is also about a lot of other things that we sometimes don't think about. And all of those things certainly causes trauma.
That was one of questions I want to get to is maybe things that we're able, people who are cisgendered can take for granted that transgender people don't. And you used a word there, pronouned, which mm-hmm. I've never heard as a verb before. Can you unpack that a little bit for me?
Yeah. Pronouned incorrectly, probably, right? So the idea that, you know, you walk into a room and it's like sir, ma'am, or he or she, and so it's mispronouned, right? And so it's, I don't even know if it's a real world word or it's an accurate word, but I use it, and so therefore I'm going to say that it is. you know, that we don't think about that being wrong because we pronoun people based on the physical assessment that we make, right? And we make that assessment on secondary sex characteristics or how people are performing or expressing their gender. And if somebody is expressing their gender in a way that we don't understand, we as a sort of collective society, and I think individually, we get really distracted by that and preoccupied with knowing what gender somebody is. And that becomes a predominant experience that is trans or gender nonconforming people who maybe are in that in-between place presentation-wise with hormone therapy or without hormone therapy or sort of trying to express a gender that is different than their assigned sex that you may not be able to know. You may not know he or she. And so people just really get preoccupied. And I think within the community, we have this chronic experience of like being misgendered, mispronounced, all these things of saying my pronoun is he, but people are referring to me as she. And there's a lot of psychic trauma that happens around that.
Yeah, I've definitely witnessed that happening where people kind of obsess if they can't figure out if where someone falls in this binary idea of male and female. Do you, in working with families, do you encounter much confusion about the differences between gender and sexuality?
Like every day? Yeah. Yeah. It's a thing for sure. And I have to tell you that there are folks that I work with who are transgender nonconforming who have to unpack that as well because we as transgender nonconforming people, we grow up in the exact same society as cisgender people, you know, so we get the exact same messaging and have to unpack a lot of that stuff. As a community and advocates, I think we've done a great job of saying like these things are two separate entities and almost to a place that is no longer servicing us because those two are different entities, but they absolutely impact and interact with each other. And we don't tell cisgender people, we don't go to great effort to sort of separate all these identities because that's something, you know, your original question of like there are hundreds upon hundreds of things every single day, every hour that cisgender people don't think about that trans people have to think about. And it can be preoccupying, and I sort of refer to it as gender noise. There's a volume that's very, very high for trans folks around names and pronouns and a variety of different things. But I think that the assumption is that the predominant factor or the driving force of gender is sexuality or who you're attracted to. And that just is not accurate. And it sort of harks back to my statement of trans people can experience a tremendous amount of trauma sitting in a room by themselves. It has nothing to do with sharing their body or being intimate in some way with another person. It's just another layer of navigation around your gender is how to then express your sexuality.
Mm. Joe, in your work as medical director for gender nonconforming children at the Center for Trans Youth and Health Development, what you work with kids? Can you talk more about that? What the age range is, and what some of the challenges they're facing? How they find their way to your office?
Sure. Our clinic is actually the largest trans youth clinic in the United States. We have about 500 young people in the program, and the age range is from 3 to 25. And certainly, kids and young people who come in they come in at vastly different ages and on vastly different places in their gender journeys. And so parents who come in or families with young children who haven't even started a puberty process yet have very different challenges and things that they're working around and with to help create safe, healthy environments for their children. They have nothing to do with medical intervention. So there aren't hormones, there aren't surgeries, there aren't things that are happening for little kids that involve the use of medicine. But where I can be really helpful for those families is in supporting them, talking with them, giving them education, connecting them to resources where they can have support primarily as parents to understand a little bit more about what their child is experiencing and how they can help create a safe environment for them. For kids who are a little bit older and they're in their early stages of puberty or in their puberty process, they are often good candidates for puberty blocking or suppression of their body's puberty so that everybody can get a little time to kind of wrap their head around what's happening for that young person. And for older youth and young adults, cross-sex hormones to masculinize or feminize to induce a puberty that matches their experienced gender. We do that as well as making surgical referrals. I do think there are some common themes, though, that run through all of those three age cohorts. And they're about helping people become more, especially families, for kids who are lucky enough to have family involvement, it's really about helping that whole family unit go through that transition and in the world and come out on the other end in a really good place. There are a lot of youth in our clinic, though, that come from foster care. They come from group homes and they come from the streets. These are runaway, throwaway youth who have been ejected from their families of origin because of their gender or gender-related issues. And those young people have a whole host of other things that they need support around.
Well, it sounds like I have so many questions there. It sounds like for the younger kids, you're intervening and kind of stopping or trying to stop some of that mental trauma before it occurs. And then I really want to ask, before we run out of time, about the advantages of transitioning early and why you would want to stave off, why people wouldn't want to go through two puberties, if that's not obvious enough. We do have a caller on the line. I'd like to go to him now. Stephen Eugene has been waiting patiently. Thank you, Stephen Eugene. You are on the air.
Howdy. Two quick questions. How long has transgender surgery actually been around, and have there been any long-term studies as to happiness, adjustment, just overall well-being of transgender patients in the long run?
Thanks for that, Steve. We appreciate your comments. That's a good question. I think it gets back to, as well, the what's going on, the interplay between the medical and the mental issues here, and what an early transition means. Would one of you like to take on Steve's questions?
Sure. I mean, we've been doing trans-related surgeries in the United States since the 1940s. They were being done in Europe earlier than that, and it was very interesting. In the 1940s and 50s, people had to largely leave the country in order to get surgery related to their trans experience. And there have been many studies that have looked at outcomes for trans folks after gender confirmation surgeries, and almost universally, all of those studies have shown improvement in outcomes after surgery. I do think there are, this speaks directly to that question about early transition. I think that for folks who transition later, significantly later in life, in their 40s and 50s, there has been a very small percentage of people who have regretted that decision to transition their physical body, not because there was some issue around their gender being unstable, but because they had had an entire life in one gender role, and that many times they lost that life with their transition.
Aiden, with 30 seconds left to go, can you give our listeners and myself maybe one universal thing to consider about how to be supportive of people who don't conform, how maybe not to obsess over.
Yeah, how to not obsess about it. You know, I think that a great starting point is to understand that people know their gender. And I think that as human beings, that our obligation is to not disprove somebody, but to really understand that if someone tells you they're trans or gender nonconforming and they ask you to use different names and pronouns, you have to use those, because by not doing it, you're harming them.
Wise words from Aiden Olson Kennedy, an associate clinical social worker, and Joe Olson Kennedy, medical director for the Center of Trans Youth. Here's Garrison Keeler.